Well, good evening and welcome to the latest in the series of Directors' Dialogues. And our guest this evening is Michael Crick from Newsnight now, I think we would have to say, though he has, of course, made his name through his books and his journalism for a variety of different outlets. Rather curiously, Michael's career and mine have a number of parallels. We were both at Manchester Grammar School. He was editor of the school newspaper called The Mancunian. And I think I can say that the only reason he could be editor of it was because I had founded it 7 years before. He then went on to Oxford, where, like me, he became editor of the Charwell newspaper, which is why it's appropriate that tonight's event is co-hosted and sponsored by The Beaver, because Michael cut his teeth on student journalism both at school and at university. Then he went to ITN and to Channel 4 News, but then found his way to the BBC, both in Washington and on Panorama, and more recently on Newsnight. But, of course, it is as an investigative journalist that he has particularly made his name. He was described by The Guardian in terms clearly calculated to offend as a rabid Yorkshire Terrier, which, for someone from Manchester, is particularly offensive. The terrier bit and the rabid bit are okay. But the Yorkshire bit is a bit much to take. Also described in press cuttings frequently as engagingly eccentric. Whether you've got not got odd socks on or anything dramatic like that. And has, of course, published a range of books, including biographies of Michael Heseltine, of Geoffrey Archer, and of Alex Ferguson at Manchester United. And it would be fair to say that these biographies have not always been wholly welcome to the subjects. But the most important book that Michael published, and indeed the only one of which he has chosen to give me a copy, is the complete Manchester United trivia fact book. And this is the point at which Michael and I part company, since I'm a supporter of Manchester City and he's a supporter of Manchester United. But is there a Manchester United supporter here? Yeah, well, Michael claims to know everything in this book. So afterwards, instead of questions on other things, we'll take only questions. Particularly tricky ones to ask. But let's not begin with Manchester United. Let's begin with how you got into journalism. Did you find student journalism a useful preparation or just a frivolous hobby?
Yes, incredibly useful. And it was the Mancunian. And I was going to acknowledge my debt for you, but you got there first. it was the Mancunian and Charwell. Although, in those days, I always saw journalism as something to do in the meantime, because eventually I intended to go into politics. And that was always my intention, really, for the first 10 years as a professional journalist. And I even, around about 1990, started putting out feelers to try and stand in a hopeless seat. And this would have been as a Labour candidate. And then I was approached by two people who said, two senior figures in the Labour Party from the Northwest, who said, are you interested in putting your name forward for Bootle, which is the safest Labour seat in England? And I thought, Bootle, I mean, the party is at war with itself in Bootle, I happen to know. I'd written a book about the militant tendency, which is why they wanted me there, to show that I was nothing to do with the militant tendency. But the idea of a Manchester United supporter being an MP in Liverpool, that wasn't going to work. My wife just, there was no way the marriage would ever carry on if we had to go and live in Liverpool. I mean, not for football reasons, but for many other reasons. And it was at that moment I decided that actually, if I wasn't going to go, I decided not to go for Bootle, and I decided if I wasn't going to go for Bootle, I really wasn't going to go for anything. And since then, I've had a complete, a great sense of freedom. Because up until that point, I always had to think about what I was doing, whether it was going to offend people in politics. And now, I just don't have to care about that anymore. And I always say to people, you just can't really mix politics and journalism, and that those people who are journalists and have ambitions to go into politics will always be handicapped by those ambitions. And so now for the last 13, 14 years, it's been journalism, and it will be for the rest of my life.
But now you are, though, in this country anyway, relatively unusual as an investigative journalist. I mean, I think it is fair to say that there are not many people who have operated in the sort of single-minded way that you have, digging around at particular stories. I mean, how did you decide to become a muckraker, an investigative journalist?
Well, muckraker actually is it's funny, the other day when The Guardian wrote that, the Guardian, just before that profile you mentioned, they said that I was the son of Bernard Crick, the politics professor. Well, I'm not the son of Bernard Crick, and all sorts of people then made it clear to the Guardian corrections column that I wasn't, including most of my family, and including Bernard Crick. And Bernard Crick sent them an email saying that my son Tom, who is an academic at Atlanta, would be deeply offended to be regarded as a muckraker, said Bernard Crick. But I mean, I don't actually regard myself I don't call myself an investigative journalist. I mean, I think all decent journalism should be investigative. It should involve research. And I've always felt as a journalist that everything you do should be telling the world something new. I mean, if you're a plain news journalist, you're obviously relaying new events to the world. There are people who are putting a new analysis on the world. There are people who are taking a subject and digging away and researching at it. And I've always found in life that if you look at any subject, it doesn't take long before you find something new on that subject. And that the commonly held orthodoxies and lines and so on are not quite right, or indeed in some cases they're totally wrong. And that to me has been the joy of being a journalist, is actually digging away at a subject persistently and sometimes doggedly and I guess I would admit obsessively on many occasions, and coming across new material and then relaying it to the world, the material that the world didn't know. And I think that all journalism should be like that. I mean, clearly there are many news journalists who haven't got the time and the resources to put into research that goes on for days, weeks and months. Nonetheless, even on daily news programs, it's quite easy to find new material, to make the extra phone calls, to go and find the extra documents that will give you that the piece that you're doing that night or that the following morning, that extra edge, that different quality that from you know, most of the stuff that goes out.
But now, the particular person you got your teeth into for a considerable period of time was Geoffrey Archer. Now, one might say that Geoffrey Archer was an obvious target in a certain sense. He was obviously a rather sort of larger-than-life character. But in another sense, not a terribly important target, because never someone who'd been a cabinet minister, indeed never likely to be. So why did you become so preoccupied with Geoffrey Archer and spend such a large chunk of your life working on him?
Well, you know, I'm not going to try and pretend to be incredibly high-minded about all this. I mean, part of it is because it paid, and part of it because it was immense fun. And I suppose what initially interested me in Archer, and indeed it's interested me in probably all of my subjects, I'm fascinated by successful people. And what makes them successful? Why are they different from most of us? What ingredients, what parts of what have they got in their characters? What sparks them off? And I'm particularly fascinated by people who are successful in more than one career. I mean, that's true of Archer. He's been successful in so many walks of life. I mean, you may dislike him, but you've got to accept he has been a successful writer. He's been a successful athlete, perhaps not a successful politician, but he has been successful in more than one thing. Michael Heseltine is another example, a man who's made... He's probably worth about $250 million now, really made from almost nothing, and also being Deputy Prime Minister. I mean, extraordinary. And it's fascinating to see the ingredients that are coming to their careers, you know, what the common ingredients and the different ingredients. In Archer's case, I think also what also makes Archer fascinating is that he tells us so much of the about the Britain of the 80s and 90s that a man like this could be successful, could maintain friendships with two successive prime ministers, with most of the British establishment, actually. They would be flocking round to Archer's house. And what was fascinating was the way in which people did not hold him to account. They did not ask questions about clearly embarrassing things in his background for a variety of reasons. They didn't ask those questions. And it was also fascinating the way in which the media had failed to call him to account. It was almost as if the media depended on Archer, you know, to enliven their coverage, their radio programs and their television programs, and he would then threaten them if they tried to dig away. He would threaten them with writs and so on. And, you know, what's fascinating about Archer is the way he got away with it in the world in which we live, and why do we let him get away with it, and why do we get a whole series, I think. There are what I call sort of, you know, there is this lovable rogue syndrome, that there are people in public life, I mean, Bill Clinton is another, Charlie Hockey is another, Terry Venables is another, who really, Richard Branson, I'd say, is another, they get away with activities largely because they're so colourful, and we actually enjoy their company, we think they enliven the world, and they get away with a lot more than a boring person would. You know, it's wrong, really, but it's fascinating that it happens, and it's well worth exploring.
Did Archer threaten you?
Well, sort of. Very early on, I was inspired to some extent by a wonderful series of books about Lyndon Johnson by an American historian called Robert Caro. In fact, funny enough, they're Michael Howard, who I'm writing about at the moment, they're one of his favourite books, and also William Hague's. And what Caro did is, he goes into immense detail about every aspect of Lyndon Johnson's life. And he tracked down, for instance, every member of, I think, the Texas Senate who'd served with Johnson. And so I said, right, well, I said to my wife, right, we've got to track down every member of the Greater London Council who served with Archer in the 1960s. And there were 99 councillors, and so we listed them all, and we found that 33 of them were dead, so that was 66. I think there were 63 left. And so we tracked them all down. In particular, there was a story about how Archer had, when he was a Conservative councillor on the GLC, had offered to do fellow Tory councillors' expenses for them, because the expenses system was very complicated, the system of expenses and allowances, and nobody really understood how to do it, and you had to fill in lots of forms. And so he went to these guys, he said, look, I'll do them for you if you give me 10%. And I just found this story just so unbelievable, really, because the amounts of money concerned were fairly minor. I mean, you know, a few tens of pounds here and there. I mean, councillors did not make a lot of money from expenses in those days. And so we tracked down all these councillors, and sure enough, we came up with, I think, about 20 councillors who remembered him doing it, and six of them who admitted that he'd done it for them. You know, several of them had gone on to become MPs and government ministers. And when we got to about number 62 on the councillors' list, Archer sent us a letter saying, if you or your wife carry on asking these questions, I won't hesitate to consult my lawyers. And and this is not true. I did not ever ask any colleagues to do my to let me do their expenses, nor did I claim 10% commission and all this. And it was at that moment I just, you know, I had total confirmation of the man's dishonesty and that he was a complete liar. And I just thought, you know, I can't remember whether he replied, but my view was, well, if you want to sue, sue. I mean, you know, the evidence is overwhelming on this one. And after that, we didn't hear from him. I mean, I think the thing about Archer, and indeed all bullies, is you've got to stand up to them. And if you do stand up to them, they tend to back off.
Do you feel sorry for him?
Not really. No. I mean, the man should have gone to jail years ago, really. I mean, a lot of money disappeared from Oxfam in the 1960s, and I think it went into Archer's pocket and is the reason why he was able to buy, while he was still nominally a student, two properties in Weston-super-Mare and in Oxford, and he should have gone to jail for that. The Anglia affair, nobody ever got to the bottom of it. DTI inspector, the Anglia shares affair, when he was suspected of insider trading, nobody could prove it. He was probably guilty there. I mean, he has done a lot of good. I accept he's raised a lot of money for charity. You know, his books are a good read. I enjoy them. I know I shouldn't admit that. A lot of millions of other people enjoy them. He has added to the gaiety of, if one can use that word of public life. But I wish he'd just stick to, you know, raising money for charity and writing his books and not try and get involved in public life. And no, I don't feel sorry for him. And, you know, I'm just hoping that maybe some good will come out of his time in jail. And, you know, some of the things he says about prison life and the problems of drugs in jail are actually, you know, quite sensible. And if he can use the rest of his life to make a bit of an impact in an area which, frankly, we all ignore penal policy and we all, you know, we're not very interested and just wish it would go away, the whole issue. If he can make an impact there, I mean, probably not now in the House of Lords because he's going to be thrown out, but if he can make an impact, then great.
Well, then you moved on from Archer to Alex Ferguson. And my feeling on reading the Ferguson book called The Boss or Boss or...
The Boss,
The
yeah.
Boss. Was that you described someone who was absolutely astonishingly unpleasant. And also you described his doubtful dealings with his son and agents, etc. And yet I felt that by the end you pulled your punches. Was that the United fan getting in the way of the investigative journalist?
No, I don't think I pulled my punches. I mean, clearly, in any of these books, there are certain things that you know but you can't say because you've got to be able to prove everything in a court of law, and the lawyers have... You know, the publishers won't publish the book unless you've satisfied the libel lawyers. And, I mean, I don't actually think, Alex, but, I mean, I think, well, like so many high achievers, Alex Ferguson is two people. And what you see with both Archer and with Ferguson, and I think probably with Rupert Murdoch, whom I started writing about at one stage, Robert Maxwell, quite a few other people in... Gordon Brown almost fits into this, not Blair, that there is an incredibly pleasant side to them, charming side. I mean, Alex Ferguson, I mean, I met him at a party once at a period when United were doing really badly. They'd lost 5-0 and 6-3, and it was 10 years. And I decided I wasn't going to talk football with him at all. That he, you know, and I would want to talk. Tried to talk to him about his trade union background and his politics and everything. And he was the most charming person I've ever met. Actually, I mean, it was astonishing. And he greeted my wife and I, and you know, we spoke to them for most of the evening, and his wife. And the end, he said goodbye, and as if he'd known us all our lives. And he can be an incredibly decent, charming, considerate man. And yet, there is the other side of Ferguson, I suppose, you know, to be blunt, the monster side of Ferguson, the man who bullies young players into signing up with his son, or tried to bully them into signing up with his son as a football agent, who regularly bullies the media. Well, people don't really care about that, and the media ought to be able to stand up to him. And the fascinating question then arises, does that combination of charm and monsterdom, I mean, I suppose Lyndon Johnson was another brilliant example of it, do you need that combination or to be successful? I suppose the answer to that is no, you don't need that combination to be successful, because I don't think it applies to Tony Blair, for instance, or, I mean, as far as I know, Nelson Mandela, for example. But I do think it is actually a pretty good formula for success, that the combination of ruthlessness and charm. And in some of these characters, they just take the ruthlessness, you know, far beyond what is necessary.
Hmm. Now, I'm going to open it up to the audience in a few minutes, but let me just pursue your next target, who was Ian Duncan Smith. Now, the Ian Duncan Smith office story, of course, we haven't quite got to the bottom of yet, as I understand it. But how does this kind of thing come to you? Do you just think, I tell you what, I think I'll go and look at Ian Duncan Smith's office expenses, or did you just get a tip-off from a disaffected employee?
Well, a bit of each, really. What happened was I did a film for Newsnight in December 2002, 14 months ago. And I said, I mean, I always think it's fascinating to look into people's early careers, because I think it tells you a lot about them. And, you know, the thing that fires people and gets them going is generally something that's happened in their early life. I mean, I know it's a statement of the obvious, really. But in Duncan Smith's case, there was very little known about his early life. And so I started looking at it, and I discovered that there were all sorts of, basically, lies on his CV. I mean, this is the CV that appears in Who's Who and was published by Conservative Central Office. And, you know, it claimed he'd been to the University of Perugia, which is a very distinguished medieval Italian university. And, you know, they'd no record of him. And I soon realized he hadn't been at the University of Perugia, but had been at another place called the University Per Stranieri, which is basically an upmarket language school, a very good language school. And I have to say that because my mother was there in the 1950s. But it isn't a university in the accepted sense. And, you know, people go there for about 3 months and they study Italian and they study a bit of Italian art. And but anyway, he was making out that this was the University of Perugia on his CV. And then also, pride of place on his CV, the number one item, and I still think it's, I think it's still there as number one item, was that he'd been at the Dunchurch College of Management. And, well, it sounded impressive, you know, it sounded like it was a sort of, you know, really important business school somewhere, and he'd got an MBA or something like that. So I explored and discovered that the Dunchurch College of Management was really the GEC Staff College in a place called Dunchurch, which is near Rugby. And that Ian Duncan Smith had been there for about 10 days altogether, one day at a time, doing, you know, staff training days, for which he might have got a certificate of attendance, but he certainly wouldn't have got even a diploma or an MBA. And this was, you know, pride of place on his CV, which I thought, you know, was all a bit dodgy. Anyway, I did the film, and it went out on Newsnight, as I say, in December 2002. Which I didn't realise at the time was also, well, I some of the things I knew and some things I didn't, but that coincided with the period when Cherie Blair was having trouble over the flats in Bristol, that story you remember. And Ian Duncan Smith had gone very strongly on that, and in doing so had opened up the possibility of people looking at his own family. And he'd always argued that he was a private man, and his family were private territory, and people shouldn't intrude on their privacy. And the same month, December 2002, a Conservative MP, Michael Trend, had been exposed as fiddling his, or having misclaimed his parliamentary housing allowance and had to pay back, I think, £80,000 and subsequently stepped down as an MP. And what I didn't know is that within Ian Duncan Smith's office, they were getting very, very, his colleagues were getting very, very worried about the fact that he'd been paying his wife from the parliamentary staffing allowance for the previous 15 months since he'd been elected Conservative leader, and yet she was doing no work. And people had tried to bring this up with him, and she was being paid the equivalent of £15,000 a year. And they could see no work that she was doing, let me rephrase it that way. And they were, you know, saying to him, look, you've got to sort this out. In actual fact, by the end of that month, December, she came off the payroll. So clearly, he did decide that things needed to be changed. And subsequently to that, one of the people who'd expressed disquiet, a woman called Vanessa Gearson, had sent an internal email that had referred, had said, we don't want there to be a Crick-style investigation into this problem over Betsy, do we? Obviously, that was a reference to the Newsnight thing I'd done. Anyway, eventually, several months later, last May, in fact, somebody came to me and told me about this story, and then I found somebody else who corroborated it. And I subsequently learned that they'd come to me. One of the reasons they'd come to me is because of this email, although I didn't actually receive a copy of the email for several more months, until September. And the BBC couldn't make up their minds whether to run this story or not. And then, of course, it was all gripped by Hutton and everything. And in the end, it was never run on the BBC or on Newsnight. I had to take it to the Parliamentary Standards Commissioner and the Sunday Telegraph.
Well, you say that in a very casual way, but many people would say something that they'd worked on and which was actually a very good story, not to be run, was a point of principle. And why didn't you quit?
Well, I sort of did in a way, in that I was suspended. I mean, I'm a freelance, so I was subsequently suspended, and it was never. I mean, there are other things about which other rows I've had within the BBC or within my employers about which I feel more strongly. And their argument was, look, it's very difficult to prove a negative. It's very difficult to prove that somebody has been doing no work or next to no work, because for all we know, she was doing something you know, that nobody's thought of, or that nobody was aware of. And they were very nervous about it, and the lawyers were nervous. And I understand a lot of that nervousness. I mean, you know, I think over the years one picks up an understanding of the libel laws, and they basically came to the conclusion that, you know, the evidence wasn't quite enough. My own view is that if it hadn't been for Hutton and the Gilligan affair, they would have run that story, would have run that story on Newsnight. The BBC, you know, from the middle, well, since after about May of last year, was gripped in this Hutton fever, which meant that the senior people, you know, didn't even have time to look at the story, let alone address it properly. And between June and September, when I was waiting for a decision to go to the next stage, I mean, nobody in the high command even looked at it. Now, should I have got really annoyed about that? Well, maybe. I mean, I have to say, I wasn't working for the BBC all of that time anyway. I was off doing other things. It's difficult to resign when you're not on the staff anyway. and having taken it to the commissioner, I was suspended. I still am suspended from Newsnight. And I suppose whether I go back, whether they have me back, depends whether the commissioner comes down in my favour or comes down in his.
What on earth is he doing? Because initially it looked as if it was going to be a two-week job.
Well, it did. And I think that once Ian Duncan Smith stepped down as Conservative leader, things slowed down because it lost all its urgency. Mm. And so therefore, everybody on both sides, both IDS's supporters and his critics, were keen to get their material in while he was still leader. Once he was no longer leader, they didn't really see much point. And so it lost all its urgency. And I think, as I understand it, I've got to be careful here because I'm probably already in contempt of Parliament by even talking about this. But anyway, things slowed down. According to what I read in the press, things slowed down. And according to what I read in the press, there was another allegation or series of allegations about which I know nothing. But as I understand it, the report's likely to come out in the next week or two. Oh. But everything I've just said was purely based on what I've read in the press.
I'm going to open it out, and the first question obviously comes from here. Have you got your tricky question?
Yeah, this one's for you. Who was the player, Manchester player, who scored two own goals in separate games against Manchester City?
Two own goals in the 60s.
In the 60s?
Would that have been Bill Fowkes?
No, Nobby Styles, wasn't it?
Yeah. Styles, well done.
Actually, it's a funny thing happened over that book because somebody wrote a book of... a Manchester United book of lists, and they lifted a lot of material from that book. And fortunately, there are one or two errors in there, very small errors, and they'd stolen my errors. So I was able to sue them for copyright on the because they've given themselves away by stealing the errors. But they're very, very minor errors, and they were corrected in the subsequent edition.
But that wasn't one of them. Questions? Yeah, one down here first, and then.
I'm editor of the Beaver here. So what I wanted to ask you was, what was your favourite moment in student journalism? And did anything you work on at Chartwell or at the Mancunian have parallels with your later, more controversial work?
Well, I have to say I was a pretty awful student journalist. I think I was probably the worst editor in Chartwell's history. So there was nothing there that would even have made the Oxford Mail, let alone the national press. But I suppose that my favourite moment, I suppose particularly when I was at school, there was always an air of mischief to my... my work, and which indeed my daughter has carried on. She set up a newsletter at her school called Private High until it got banned. But I used to do a column called Fifth Column, and we did a survey. Fifth Column has done a survey to find the most unpopular master in the school, and he is not listed below, and then I listed all the initials of because at MGS they used to call all the teachers by their initials, and you had this great crowd of masters hanging around working out who it must be, you know. And of course the joke was I'd put them all in, and of course, you know, there wasn't one, but so it was huge fun. That
well, that's an idea for a feature.
Yeah. And change the course of civilization as we know it. Yeah,
one over here, thanks, and then.
Bernard Herrmann. How much difference in influence upon your work as a political journalist has it been that there's no great obvious ideological divide between the main political parties in the way there was during the 1980s? Tony Blair, 20 years ago, could have been mistaken for a young Conservative MP. I mean, obviously, this is a very different situation when you first started your career, and how does it impact upon your present journalism?
Yeah, I think that is crucial, that development. I mean, it is so important to everything that's happened to me over the last 25 years. I mean, when I joined ITN as a trainee in January 1980, I remember the big story was the steel strike. And every story that ITN did in those days broke down between left and right. It was the Cold War, it was capital against labour, it was strikes. You had three industrial correspondents who were essentially strikes correspondents. And everything was a story of serious confrontation between East and West, capital and labour, socialism and capitalism. Now, that has almost entirely broken down, so that we now live in a world where journalism is all about more efficient... Well, in fact, the world, debate and dispute in the world is largely about more efficient ways of running things. Journalism is about character. It's much more gossip-based. It's about acts of incompetence. It has transformed, I think, not just journalism, but the Western world. Now, whether it will carry on in this way, but it does mean that our newspapers are very different and our television programmes and are very different vehicles than what they would have been 25 years ago. And there is a lot more focus on the minutiae, the details of character, of acts of competence or incompetence.
Hello, my name's Jeremy Asher. You said that you've been working on Rupert Murdoch and then you stopped. I'm just curious, why did you stop?
I have to be totally honest, two reasons. The subject was so big and I realised I was getting bored by it. I know it's an awful thing to admit, but to say anything else, I would be lying. And Rupert Murdoch has been an active media owner for longer than Tony Blair has been living. His empire covers, Australia, large parts of America, Britain, Hong Kong, other countries. It's just incredibly complicated. It is just such a big subject that I realised it was to do it properly, to do it justice, and to do something different from what everybody else has done. It was going to take me years and years and years. And I just found myself constantly being more interested in things that distracted me. And after a year, I just said to myself, look, Crick, you've got to admit it. You don't want to write this book. And I didn't. I've still got all the stuff. I may come back to it. There's still, lots of fascinating material I did uncover that hasn't been published anywhere, fascinating leads to explore. But it, not for now anyway. Maybe later, maybe when he's dead, although the way things are going, that's going to be a very long time. I just couldn't see myself doing it for the next 5 or 10 years that it was going to take.
I'm sure Rupert Murdoch has been very upset about that. I think there's one right in the middle here.
Thanks. My name is Michael Honey. Two questions, really. One, you said that Tony Blair wasn't included in your sort of split personality list, so I'd just like you to expand on that a bit. And secondly, Carl was just asking you about Huffman and the Gilligan report and everything that flowed from that.
On the Tony Blair thing, I mean, I think... there may be aspects of Tony Blair's character we don't like, but I don't think anybody would ever accuse him of being a monster, of being, and there are people around him we might accuse of being monsters or having undesirable qualities. Well, even some of those have got this combination of charm and being utter bastards, basically. I mean, I think you could put Campbell in that category and Mandelson too. But both can be utterly delightful at times, and they can be impossible to work with or be with at times as well. Whereas Blair, I don't think falls into that category from the little I know about him. I mean, I've only met him on a few occasions, when I can only go by what I read and what people say about him. But I don't think he falls into that category. And Michael Howard, on the other hand, well, we'll have to wait and see, won't we, for what I have to say in my book. But
when is that coming out? Before the election?
Before the election, yeah. Either late this year or early next year. On the Hutton thing, well, what is there to say about it? I mean, you know, we could do a whole thing on Hutton. And I mean, I do think the, like, you know, most people in my profession, I do think the Hutton report was terribly unjust to the BBC, or at least it was unjust in as much as the criticisms of the BBC that Hutton makes were almost all entirely justified. But the trouble was, because there was so little criticism of the government, it made it look as if the BBC had been absolutely terrible and awful, whereas if it had been balanced with, in my view, what should have been proper criticisms of the government, then the impact on the BBC would have been nothing like as great. And I think it is bad news that Greg Dyke and Gavin Davis had to resign, and I think it's going to be bad news for the BBC if... and I think we are going to see a period of even greater caution. I saw that over the summer with the IDS story, particularly if certain people take over at the BBC. But in the long term, I don't think that will carry on forever. You know, it may go on for 2 or 3 years, but then people will become emboldened again, and you know, there'll be a new government or a new prime minister or whatever, and things will change. So it won't have disastrous consequences forever, but there will be a period where we are cowed into being, you know, too nice to politicians, in my view, and, you know, probably too cautious in digging away at government activity.
You say mysteriously, if certain people take over, who are these certain people? Name names.
Well, I'll be blunt about it. I don't think if Mark Byford becomes Director General of the BBC, I don't think that would be good news for the BBC. I don't think I've ever seen a worse performance on Newsnight in 24 years of watching the programme from the one he did in the week of Hutton. And some of the things he has said since taking over are, you know, bad news for people who believe in my kind of journalism. And I suppose now I've said that, I won't be working there if he does take over, so that's that. No, I do. I mean, I think there are some very good people who would be good directors general around, some at the BBC and some outside the BBC. On the whole, I think to be a good director general of the BBC, you should have worked somewhere else. I think the idea that you can purely work within an organisation and then take it over without, especially in the modern media world, where it's so much, you've got to understand how it all works and commercial possibilities and understand that there are different ways of doing things. Certainly, I think they've got to go for somebody who has had a significant period of time outside.
So, who's the next one over there? Yeah.
Hello. You claim to be a Manchester United fan. How could you have written the biography of Alec Ferguson and slated him in the way that you did when he's won so much success with Manchester United?
Well, I mean, I say a lot of nice things about him in the book as well. You know, I think you have to read the book to get the balance. Obviously, people, you have read the book. And, you know, it was difficult for me. But at the end of the day, I am a journalist first and a United fan second. And if I felt, you know, that what I was describing and what I discovered was the truth and accurate, then, you know, I'm obliged to say so. I think that to write a hagiography, he's not really doing anybody any good apart from possibly him. And there's plenty of those already. You know, nearly all successful people have faults, and as we've been discussing, some of them have huge faults, and that's what makes them so interesting. And I suppose the fascinating thing with Ferguson is, does he require, and indeed many of these other people, do you need that level of ruthlessness to succeed? And I suppose the answer is, in many cases, well, a fair degree of ruthlessness is very helpful to success, but maybe not quite as much as he's shown.
I mean, the most extraordinary thing I thought in that book was I think if I get this right, was that the Manchester Evening News, which is part of the Guardian group, under pressure from Ferguson, refused you access to their public archive.
No, it was worse than that, Howard. It was the Manchester Evening News. I asked whether I could use their cuttings library, which I've used in the past, and they charge £75 a day or something, which is fair enough. I was prepared to pay that. And they said, well, you can't come and use it unless you get permission from Ferguson and from Old Trafford. Well, I knew I was pretty unlikely to get permission anyway, but it was the principle of the thing. I didn't see why I should have to go and ask the permission of the subject or of United to get this access. I mean, if you were asking The Guardian to use their Cuttings Library and writing a book about Tony Blair, and they turned around and said, well, you need permission from Downing Street, we'd all think it was an outrage. And what it illustrated to me was the way in which the Manchester Evening News is terrified of Ferguson and of United. And, you know, that's not journalism, that's just arse-licking. I mean, it really was. I mean, they said they'd had, you know, all sorts of run-ins with Ferguson over the years. Well, you know, if you are doing a proper job and you are the local press and the local media, it's part of your journalistic duty to hold local institutions and individuals to account. And there will be the odd run-in, and you should learn to cope with these things instead of just sort of behaving in the most pathetic manner. And on top of that, the editor of the Manchester Evening News didn't even have the guts to respond to my emails. So as a result, I'm boycotting the Evening News forevermore. Won't read it, and certainly won't buy it. No, I'll read it, but I won't buy it, and I certainly won't work for it. And surprise, surprise, they didn't review my book.
I remember Honora O'Neill's brief lectures on trust a couple of years ago, and one of the points she repeatedly made was about the esteem with which the public holds various professions. And she quoted that journalists frequently get accorded the least amount of trust from the public. I was wondering if you want to comment on that, and also about criticisms of lack of accountability of journalists.
Well, I think estate agents come a few points lower, don't they? But, I mean, it is a problem. All I'd say from my point of view is that broadcasters are much more highly regarded than print journalists. And understandably, I think if you were to divide that question between print, broadsheet journalists and tabloid journalists, there'd probably be a huge difference there. But we are held in low esteem in this country, and to a large extent, well, to some extent, justifiably so. I mean, I think some of the things that journalists get up to in this country are outrageous. Fabrications, intrusions into private life, all over the place. Lack of respect for the facts. And journalism in Britain is far less professional than it is in the United States. And I would love to see journalism here become more professional. We are gradually edging in that direction, which, you know, if some good comes out of Hutton, maybe it will make BBC journalists, all journalists, more professional.
Why do you think it is so much less professional than in the US?
Well, I suppose it's because in the US, the journalists are almost part of the Constitution. The idea that you have a free press and that it is respected and defended. It's always had a much higher status in the United States. And as a result, you have things like correction columns, although they're starting to have those here. You have fact checkers on American... I remember a chap did an article for The New Yorker, and he came to interview me, and then in the article in The New Yorker, he described having lunch with me, and he said how I'd turned up with a red scarf. And the fact checker rang up, and the first question was, "Were you wearing a red scarf when you had lunch with so and so?" But that is all to be admired. And there is not, we have not yet got. I think we're moving in the right direction, but we haven't got into the to a culture where we regard ourselves as a profession. It's still too much regarded, I suppose, as a trade. And maybe if something good will come out of the expansion of journalism and media studies schools in our universities, if a greater professionalism comes out of that, then great.
I mean, I think you've just answered what my next point was, just about comments, corrections and clarifications in newspapers, say. I mean, clearly, do you think enough effort has been expended on that? And what do you think would be the right sort of balance in terms of that sort of activity?
Well, I mean, it is. They are spreading. I mean, several newspapers now do regularly do corrections and And indeed, some of the corrections are so trivial that you wonder why they bother. But I suppose by doing, and also it's very clever, because of course by doing a corrections column, you're making it look as if everything else that we said was 100% true, which of course we know it wasn't. I mean, the difficulty, of course, is with broadcasters, because of course it's, I mean, a correction column in The Guardian takes up, what, you know, 10 column inches or whatever, whereas for broadcasters to do a regular corrections column is much more difficult. And of course, in either medium, it's not very satisfactory, because the correction needs to be made in the same place, really, and given the same prominence as the original error. Now, that rarely happens unless it's forced upon a newspaper by a court action or a court settlement. As for accountability, well, I mean, we could talk all night about that, but I just think we've got to do more. I think we have got to be more condemning, perhaps, of journalists who do, frankly, make things up, who do run stories they know not to be true, because it tarnishes us all.
Yeah.
You said about Ferguson that the formula for his success is ruthlessness and charm. Would you say that it's also the formula for your success as journalist?
Well, definitely not, because I don't think anybody would ever say I had any charm. So maybe a bit of... certainly I can be a bully, like Ferguson at times. No, clearly one... to be able to persuade people to do things, to inspire them... get them, energize them, is likely to be one ingredient of success in nearly every walk of life. Equally, to be able to know when somebody has to be sacked, and to lay down very firmly your principles, and to demolish the opposition or demolish any opposition that is getting in the way very firmly. Can at times also be a very useful way of achieving success in life. I mean, I think, having said that, you know, the ingredients of Alex Ferguson's success and the ingredients of the successes of many other public figures are much wider than that. I mean, Ferguson actually does illustrate so many other qualities one needs, like intelligence, single-mindedness, physical energy, judge of character, doggedness. And then, of course, there's the motivation to start with. What is it that fires the rockets? And I think it's always fascinating when studying people like Murdoch and Ferguson and all of these people. What fired the rockets in the first place? And I mean, the interesting thing, the parallel between Ferguson and Murdoch, although as far as I know they're not great friends, is that they both had fathers who were never satisfied with their success. Ferguson would come home having scored 4 goals, and his dad would want to know why he hadn't scored 6. Equally, Murdoch's father always thought that Rupert was going to be a complete disaster, he was going to gamble away whatever money he inherited, on the racetrack. And of course, I think that actually satisfying their fathers, who in both cases died long ago, has been part of the motivating forces behind both men.
So you're still trying to satisfy Bernard Crickley?
Absolutely, yeah.
Hi, you talked about journalistic integrity, so I was wondering what your initial reaction was to Jason Blair in the New York Times a couple of years ago, and the fact that it happened on a newspaper of such repute as the New York Times.
Well, I know of the story. I don't know the minute details of what went on there. It is very, very sad, but I'm sure things just as bad as that have gone on in this country. And gone on in this country far more regularly than they went on in America. I mean, it became a big thing in America because it was, I think, so exceptional. Whereas here, I'm sorry, our national newspapers make stuff up, still make stuff up all the time, make quotes up. You will find people who've been supposedly interviewed, who've never been interviewed in their lives by that newspaper. It probably is getting slightly better, but. Our standards are just so much lower than in America. I mean, the fascinating thing about America is how... I mean, one of the other things about America, I always found it was incredibly useful when I was a reporter there. You'd read a big feature article, and they would always attribute virtually all the thoughts that were in the article would be attributed to people that they'd interviewed. So if you were doing, a background piece on something. It was great. It was a big feature in the New York Times or the Washington Post with 20 possible interviewees. Whereas in this country, the background feature article would have all the same thoughts, but very few specific people would be cited as being behind those thoughts. Which again, you could argue, is slightly dishonest too, in that a feature writer is taking on thoughts and ideas as their own without attributing to the people from whom he got them in the first place. That's really it, I suppose.
I would say it's a heroic view to think that things are getting better. I think you could possibly argue the reverse, and certainly in the past. And the first time I wrote an article for the Times, which is probably a bit before you ever did, Michael, was in the late 70s, I think, and I wrote about the parliamentary club in South Africa, and I referred to the fact that it was bizarre, this enormous club, which was just for 160 white members of the South African Parliament. And that was an aside about the rest of the article. And I put it in, and they said, yes, they'd take this, which I was very pleased about, since I'd never had an article in the Times before. And then 2 days later, a very gentle fellow rang me up, and he said, 160 members. And I said, yes. He said, that is the number of members of Parliament in South Africa. And so I said, yes. He said, it'd be odd if the upper house weren't members too, wouldn't it? I said, well, I thought it probably would odd. He said, would you terribly mind if I added the 80 members of the South African upper house to this? And that was the Times, circa 1978, 79. They actually had people who did that stuff. But sometime between now and then, they've gone. And I don't see any sign of them coming back. So what do you base your optimism?
Well, I think the trends, I think probably the broadsheets have probably got worse, and the tabloids have probably got better, is the first thing I'd say. And overall, it's the tabloids that sell, and not the broadsheets. Secondly, you can cite all sorts of stories that were simply never covered 20, 30, 40 years ago. Winston Churchill's illness when he was Prime Minister for the second time and in a pretty bad way and barely able to run the government. Everybody, lots of journalists knew about this, but there was a sort of gentleman's agreement that they wouldn't cover it. There are all sorts of areas that were just sort of regarded as you just don't talk about it, and the world of cosy clubs of specialist journalists, which still exists to some extent, meant that certain things just weren't dealt with. People are at least, I think, getting more robust, and they're not prepared to be hoodwinked in quite the same way by people in power, I suppose, in its widest sense. And they're not prepared, journalists aren't prepared to take things at face value in quite the way they did in the past. Of course, there are dangers to that too. I mean, you could say that people like me going around asking cheeky questions does, in a small way, contribute to an undermining of authority. If my daughter sees me asking a politician a cheeky question on television, is she not likely to then think she can ask one of her teachers a cheeky question in class? That does worry me, and one has to be has to think about it at least. Bit of a diversion, that, sorry.
Well, yeah.
Do you think that perhaps part of what undermined the cosy world that let Winston Churchill get away with his illness was the trade culture that you've said you wanted to replace with a professional culture, as in America, and that a professional, very preparatorial style culture could undermine sort of the element of competition which will lead to, if a story isn't being covered, it will be by someone else, and the competition which could improve standards in that way?
Sorry, can you elaborate? I don't really see what you're getting at.
If you have you've argued at one point that you want to replace the trade-based culture we have here with the professional culture in America. You've also argued that there's been a positive change away from a cosy world where there could be a gentleman's agreement and not cover a story. Do you think that those two objectives slightly contradict each other?
Possibly. What I mean by the cosy world of correspondence is that in most areas of news reporting, there are groups of correspondents, political correspondents, industrial correspondents, agricultural correspondents, education correspondents, who established close relationships with their sources. Because they become so dependent on their sources, they don't. They're worried about embarrassing them. I mean, I suppose football is the worst example of all, in that, you know, no football correspondent ever asks a challenging question of Alex Ferguson about. I don't think any football correspondent has ever asked Alex Ferguson about the role of his son Jason. If we can break away from those cozy worlds of specialist groups, I think that would be to the benefit of journalism and to the greater professionalization of journalism, in that we would ask the questions that ought to be asked. At the same time, I think the instilling of higher standards within journalism is something that goes much wider than the groups of specialist journalists, and I think it goes much wider even than simply people in journalism. It goes to society as a whole. We have to be much more willing to condemn papers when their standards slip, or broadcasters when their standards slip, and our universities and that are increasingly teaching journalism need to, I think, help make the profession more of a profession. So I don't think there is a conflict there, no.
We ought to wind up, Michael, but just one last question from me. You confessed to your background in the Labour Party, and in fact the people you have pursued most assiduously have been Geoffrey Archer and Michael Heseltine, Ian Duncan Smith, and now Michael Howard. Are you just a Labour stooge, basically?
Well, I don't think... I don't think Peter Mandelson would think that, or Alistair Campbell, and I'm quite proud of the fact that at the last general election, I went along to nearly every one of Labour's morning press conferences, and I wasn't allowed to ask a question once by Gordon Brown, who was chairing those events. I mean, in terms of the sequence of people I've written about recently, it is, I suppose, a little unfortunate. It's just all the Labour people, somebody's got there first. Most of them have already been written about. But, I mean, in the 70s, I wrote a book about Arthur Scargill and about the militant tendency.
So another anti-Labour person.
Sorry?
Another anti-Labour.
I suppose he was.
He was the big threat to the Labour Party at the time.
Yeah. But I've done plenty of television work on senior Labour figures that did not please them. So I don't think you need to worry about that.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Michael. Been fun. Thank you.